of the things that needs to be said, and I say it one way or another in every class I teach, is how is it that somebody white is teaching American black literature? And is that presumptuous? And my first response is, well, hell, it's about time. And then my second response is really one that lasts for 11 weeks, that is a quarter of teaching students and interacting and developing relationships that are, developing credibility and sincerity and those kind of things over that 11-week period. But now, if you just walk into a class, and someone said at the last session a couple days ago, or was it yesterday, that they were surprised, told me afterwards, I was surprised that you were white. I'm interested, before we start this, especially since this time it's a study of growing up black in America, what are your reactions to that? Anybody? That, meaning a white person teaching American black literature. No reactions? Yeah?
I'm glad we have a few black people in room to keep you honest so we can tell if you really
are. That's a good point. I might throw out, though, and maybe I've done this before too, is that black people in America are victims of the same kind of racist education that we white people are victims of. Meaning, the canon that they've read, I mean, I encounter countless black students who don't know who Richard Wright is. You know, unless their parents happen to have some black authors in their library at home, they don't know him either, and you probably didn't either when you were at least young. I mean, you heard of white authors and poets before you heard of black poets and authors. But you're right, I think that helps a white audience feel anyway that I'm going to be honest.
We knew a couple like James Weldon Johnson, but he wrote kind of like white.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I just today read that great hymn that James Weldon Johnson has in our Lutheran Book of Worship. You look it up sometime, I think it's number 242, and I encourage you to that isn't what you're pointing out, I just happen to add that now, that James Weldon Johnson, the great American black poet, has that hymn in the Lutheran Book of Worship. And we can say to that, it's about time. Okay, anybody else, any reactions?
Well, I think of the purpose of literature, one of the purposes is to stretch your imagination, and so I think it's about time that whites stretch their imagination to encompass black literature.
Yep. I would sure argue, both personally and professionally, that there's a real need for those of us who have grown up in white America to finally look at the black experience in America, or the American Native experience, or some experience that is other than the experience of those who have had the political power and economic power and social power and all kinds of power in our country for centuries, and to finally look at that. If you want to study the issues in South Africa, to make a parallel, I would surely argue that you need to read the literature of the oppressed, not the literature of the oppressor. We get plenty of reports on television I'm putting quotes around it, of the literature of the oppressor. And we'll hear what Caterpillar says about South Africa. Where I come from, we hear what John Deere, one of the great companies in our Quad City area, says about South Africa. Frankly, I'm more interested in what Desmond Tutu says about South Africa than I am what John Deere says. And those are specific illustrations of that concept, of that we need to read what the oppressed say rather than the oppressor. We need to learn, and I've said this in some other sessions, what slavery was like by reading what the slaves said, not by what slave owners said. And then that, who is it? Arne Bontemps, an editor, a collector of slave narratives, said, "'Tis not he who looked on who tells the truth, but he who endured." He could have meant she who endured too, but he just didn't say it that way. Or anybody else? Yeah?
I would think it's certainly possible to teach it. I think one could be presumptuous and think that because one teaches and knows the literature, that one has come out of the experience as a white person, which is not true.
Yep.
I think we also have to listen to their voice teach us.
Yep. And that's a great point, and that's why tonight our voice will not be Paul Olson's. Our voice will be Langston Hughes. And we'll listen to his dialect and dialogue, and we'll listen and we'll watch this family interact, and we'll see what the black experience is. So indeed, we will have this glimpse that perhaps many of us have never had before. What is it like, at least in this one situation? And surely this cannot be stereotyped into all young black people, and this is how they grew up. But this is one dimension of the black experience, growing up black. And the title of this was Despair or Dreams? And what we have in this wonderful little chapter, again, this is Langston Hughes, more famous really for his poetry, and I think that's probably legitimate to be more famous for that. But this is a really good novel, and I think it doesn't get the credit in literary circles that it deserves. This chapter is from Langston Hughes' novel, Not Without Laughter. The title, just hear it again, Not Without Laughter. Takes place in the Depression. And you might want to read it alongside of that famous book, I don't know if we read it or not, but John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, you know, the book that this is the Depression, right? Well, that's one look at the Depression. This is another. And Hughes takes a really different view of that. My look at the Depression and that general era of growing up is one that is not without laughter. And we'll see then. And that's what I've listed for us to look for as we go through. And what I'd like to do then is read parts of the story, since we haven't read it, and just skim through this story quickly, but surely highlighting the special parts of Hughes's dialogue, and then try to develop the relationships that are happening in this chapter, and then just kind of categorize what's going on here. Is it dreams, or is it despair? And it's a struggle between both of those, and I think any good novel, any good literature is going to always have that tension, because the human experience, of course, is one of tension. And if it's good literature, it has to deal with the complications of the human expression. Okay, I think we can just take right off into this. I just see in my notes now something that's worth reading, so I will add it, and in other words, back up a little bit. I think one of the things that happens, whether you're white or black, and you're making the study of American black literature, is that, and I mentioned this before, we legitimize, so to speak, the American literature canon. And I've spoken about that several times and won't do it anymore. We can feel in a way that we can't otherwise and be aware of the American black experience. For most of us, our understanding of the black experience in America comes from a pretty controlled and filtered media. I mean, it's news, and who filters the news? For the most part, it's white male America. Our perceptions come from the television shows that are on there, and for the most part, who controls those? White male America. And so then maybe through this literature we can move beyond those, and I've called them filtered, and that's probably a nice word, maybe even a euphemism, maybe it should be that they're, directed and defining kinds of, power that comes out of those definitions of black America. And I think then in literature, we can move beyond what many of us have, those sociological and historical generalizations that we can make. We won't generalize now about the Depression. We're going to look at Sandy, a little 12-year-old boy growing up in America.
I was just wondering what you thought about, say, Alex Haley's books, The Color of Purple, two books that were, you know, make some pretty big impacts. Black authors.
Thought about them in what sense?
In the terms that you're just talking, as far as what kind of a slant.
The media, the presenter that they give to us. Just because we have black people presenting the image, you know it's going to be more honest. You know it's going to be... all writing moves out of and grows out of the experience of the writer. So that's why a white slave owner can't really explain what slavery is, because his experience or her experience is different. So Alex Haley, of course, is black, and he moves out of that experience plus his own study of what all that roots was. And Alice Walker, of course, is black and female, and that book is both is liberation both for female and for blackness in America. So, those are good, honest expressions, and once again, we might say it's about time that something became that important in American art. Good question. Anybody else before we take off? Does that satisfy? I skirted around that, or?
It pretty much answered it. I just wondered how much the white influence in turning that into a movie, and all of the interviews that were done after the book was written.
Yeah.
That's in both cases.
Yeah.
That's a different kind of question. The white, in how you blame that, I know that American black males, both friends of mine as well as literary critics, were quite critical of The Color Purple movie and how it rendered the images of the male as opposed to how the male image is rendered in the book, The Color Purple. I might just suggest to you, if that was of interest to you, read the book and make your own kind of comparisons. But surely, at least I'll just speak for the black friends who spoke to me and then the black literary critics that I read will say that The Color Purple movie wasn't very honest. You know, it was too hard on the black male and ignored the racial oppression that helped create that black male's responses as they were. He too was oppressed, you know, and that was part of how he handled his wife. Yeah. Anybody else with my story? Okay. This is, the characters in this chapter are Hagar, who is the grandmother of Sandy, and he's the main protagonist, he's the main hero, he's the main guy in the story, not without laughter in the whole novel, it's his growing up story. And Hagar has three children, and we'll meet them all. Angie is Sandy's mother. Angie is married to Jim Boy, but you find in the novel that Jim Boy leaves home, and he comes home and stays for a couple weeks, and then he leaves, and he does because in Stamps, Kansas, he can't get a job. Or Stanton City it is. Stamps is my Angela's book. He can't get a job there, and you have to be white to belong to the union, so he goes off to work, and he works on the railroad, and he holds a job, and then the union comes along, and he's, you know, in a lot of ways, it points out the black American experience for males, young males, trying to find employment in America. Anyway, Angie is married to Jim Boy. He is not home very often. When he is home, there's great joy and love in the family, and the rest of the novel makes that clear. Sandy is their son. Harriet, we'll just hear we'll hear Hagar talk about Harriet, is another one of her three daughters. And Harriet is about 17, and she's left home because she says, "Why go to school? All I'm going to do is work in some white woman's kitchen anyway, so I'm going to quit." And she takes off and works. She's got great musical talent, so she sings, she prostitutes herself, and she works in a motel. It's important that you remember, as we come to Hagar's dealings by mail with Harriet, that Harriet is a prostitute and that Hagar knows that. And Hagar is this conservative, fundamental Christian woman. And her daughter is making money by prostituting herself. You'll see how that fits in this whole scheme as we go too. And then the last child of Hagar is Tempe. And Tempe has really kind of made it in this novel, economically and socially. Her husband is a postal worker. They live in a brick house. They have indoor plumbing. They really are middle class people. And they don't even belong to the Baptist church anymore. They're now Episcopalians. So that's all part of that whole story. Okay, this is the chapter Christmas from Not Without Laughter. "Poor little thing," said Hagar, "poor little thing, and here we ain't got no money." The night before on Saturday, Hagar had bought a sack of flour, a chunk of salt pork, and some groceries. Old Dr. McDillers had called in this afternoon, and she had paid him, too. "I reckon it wouldn't take more than $30 to send for Harriet, and Lord knows we ain't got $3 in the house." Just right away, what are your reactions to that? I'm not looking for anything profound, just like rich or poor, that kind of stuff. These guys don't have a lot of money. But what else do you make of it? Again, I'm not looking for anything profound, so don't hesitate just to...
Yeah, honest.
Yeah, good.
Pay their bills.
Yep, honest, pay their bills. Hard-working people, and I'm gonna meet my obligations. That's very good.
Looking out for family.
Yep, looking out for family.
Generous,
good. Okay, all those things we see, and that's a sign of a good writer. You get all that, I mean, you got it, out of what? Just a couple sentences.
Also emotional and feeling, because they're talking about, obviously, the child that,
yes,
her child that she feels sorry for.
Yep. Who do you think poor little thing is? That's hard to guess right away, perhaps, but I might be wrong, it could be, it's Harriet. Poor little daughter, she's away, and you know, if we just had $30, we could get her home. Poor thing, she's not even home on Christmas. And that's all that, okay, good. Well, Angie, now her other daughter, who lives with Hagar. Hagar, Angie, and Sandy live in the same house. Okay. Angie lay limply back on her pillow, staring out of the window at the falling snow. She had been crying. Angie is ill, and you'll find that out. Not seriously ill, but she's like something like the flu. It's got her down for a couple weeks. But a couple weeks to a black woman who works in a white woman's kitchen is a whole lot of money, and it's a big proportion of what's going on, and that's why they don't have any money at Christmas time. But never mind, her mother went on. I was going to see Mr. John Frank tomorrow and see can't I borrow a little more money on this mortgage we've got with him. So on Monday morning, the old lady left her washing and went uptown to the office of the moneylender. But the clerk there said Mr. Frank had gone to Chicago and would not be back for 2 weeks. There was nothing the clerk could do about it since he himself could not lend money. So in this system as we have it, they're stuck for now. I mean, they can eat, but they can't get that $30, you know, to get Harriet home. They can't get something to make Christmas a little special. And we see that the system. And then let's skip down right after the space there. The gray days passed, and Angie was able to get up and sit beside the kitchen stove while her mother ironed. Every afternoon, Sandy went down to look at the shop windows, gay with Christmas things. What is Hagar, the grandmother, what does she do?
Good laundry.
Yep. And you'll see that, and you'll see these, and if I can talk like an English teacher for a second, you'll see these symbols of laundry and of that kind of work in the house. And you'll see this symbol is a big symbol come Christmas time. You know, instead of a Christmas tree in their yard and in their house, they got laundry hanging up inside. Grandma's got to work. Well, every afternoon, Sandy went down to look at the shop windows, gay with Christmas things. And he would stand and stare at the golden flyer sleds in Edmondson's hardware shop. He could feel himself coasting down a long hill on one of those light, swift, red and yellow coasters, the envy of all the other boys, white and color, who looked on. I won't stop your paragraph, we'll go crazy, but so far, what do you make of that? Sandy.
Dreamer.
Yeah. He's a dreamer.
Very normal boy.
Good. And he's a very normal boy with these dreams. All he wants is a sled, and he wants to be the envy of the other kids who are looking, look what I've got. And note that this sled is light and fast, and it's going to skim across the snow, and he's going to have the best one of all. And dreams get meet head-on with reality in not too long. When he went home, he described the sled minutely to Angie and Aunt Hagar and wondered about aloud if that might be what he would get for Christmas. But Hagar would say, Santa Claus are just like other folks. You don't work for nothing. And his mother would add weakly from her chair, this is going to be a slim Christmas, honey, but Mom will see what she can do. She knew his heart was set on the sled, and he could tell that she knew, so maybe he would get it. Any feelings?
I think it's tear-jerking. You want to just go buy the kid the sled and, you know, just kind of reach in and do something.
Where were you when this kid was dreaming? Yeah, it is a tear-jerker. And what is it? What are the things that bring out these tears? One, you've already mentioned, the dream. But what's happening to Sandy's dream?
It's going flat.
For sure, it's going to go flat, and they see that, too. That's good. Anything else? The dream as it relates to Harriet, pardon me, that's it, to Hagar, that's his grandmother, to Hagar and Angie. What's happening to that dream with those two? Don't they participate in it too? And aren't they depressed along, boy, we want him to have this. So note already that they're really in the sincerest sense of the word, participating too in this dream. Why?
They hope.
For sure. Good answer.
He represents the younger generation, and they want him to have a different life.
Yeah. And that's a theme that runs through all black literature of the other, you know, the older generation wants a different for the younger generation. It's a very good point. I'm looking for, and this is bad teaching, I'm fishing for one word.
Love.
Yep, that's the one I want. All the other things we said are right and important. But note from the beginning, and you'll see it in the whole novel, that starts right over here. And the reason they too participate in this dream is that it's simple. they love Sandy, and they'd like to get him that sled. So, image, and I'm going to have us lift these at the end, and I'll go a little bit faster now. We're going to list what we can find, the images of love, or of hope and dreams, and here's one. One day, Angie gathered her strength together, put a woolen dress over her kimono, wrapped a heavy cloak about herself, and went out into the backyard. Sandy, from the window, watched her picking her way slowly across the frozen ground towards the outhouse. At the trash pile near the alley fence, she stopped and, stooping down, began to pull short pieces of boards and wood from the little pile of lumber that had been left there since last summer by the carpenters who had built the porch. Several times in her labor, she rose and leaned weakly against the back fence for support, and once Sandy ran out to see if he could help her, but she told him irritably to get back in the house out of the weather, or she'd put him to bed without any supper. Then, after placing the boards that she had succeeded in unearthing in a pile by the path, she came wearily back to the kitchen, trembling with cold. "I'm mighty weak yet," she said to Hagar, who was her mother, "but I'm sure much better than I was. I don't want to have the grip no more. Sandy, look in the mailbox and see is the mailman come by yet?" All we need to know there is that she's looking in the mail for a letter from her husband, hoping that he'll be home. Well, then let's turn the page and go all the way over to the bottom of that page. Hagar runs out, that's Grandma, runs out to find out if this neighbor down the street who's a carpenter, Mr. Logan, can build the sled. And she comes back and says, yeah, he'll agree to build the sled. They don't tell Sandy this. Hagar just tells Angie, of course, Sandy's mother. And then Sandy then is sent to return the clothes that Hagar has been washing all day. And we'll read, beginning there, that bottom paragraph on 146. At the back door of the Reinhardt's house, they're the white people for whom she's been washing clothes, a warm smell of plum pudding and mince pies drifted out as he waited for the cook to bring the money. When she returned with 75 cents, she had a nickel for Sandy, too. As he slid along the street, he saw in many windows gay holly wreaths with red berries and big bows of ribbon tied to them. Sandy wished he could buy a holly wreath for their house. It might make his mother's room look cheerful. At home, it didn't seem like Christmas, with a kitchen full of drying clothes and no Christmas tree. Talk to me, folks. What do you make of that? Sandy? What's he want to?
He wants to buy a gift too.
Yeah. And so, from the beginning, this little kid who's maybe matured beyond his years, what's he want for Christmas? Sled, that's his childhood, his childlikeness, and a wreath for mom, who's sick. Maybe that will make her room a little more cheery. One of the things we're going to suggest is that, and it's hard to, well, you can see it, but as I, in my mind, think of the whole novel, it's clear in this novel that part of the strength and the spirit comes from blackness, from the cultural tradition that they that the black people in this novel have of strength, of overcoming despair, and that's clear, I think, even with how Hagar and Angie treat this whole this whole Christmas season. Sandy wondered if, after all, Santa Claus might, by some good fortune, bring him that golden flyer sled on Christmas morning. How fine this hard snow would be to coast on, down the long hill, past the hickory woods. How light and swift he would fly with his new sled. Certainly he had been a good boy, carrying on Hagar's clothes for her, waiting on his mother when she was in bed, emptying the slops and cutting wood every day, and at night when he said his prayers. And there's the prayer, and he added with great earnestness, and let Santa bring me a golden flyer sled. Please, Lord, amen, alone. But Sandy knew very well that there wasn't really any Santa Claus. He knew in his heart that Hagar and his mother were Santa Claus, and that they didn't have any money. They were poor people. He was wearing his mama's shoes, as Jimmy Lane had once done. And his father and Harriet, who used to make the house gay, laughing and singing, were far away somewhere. There wasn't any Santa Claus. And then we meet kind of another reality. I don't care he said, tramping over. You guys, our parents, you ever heard your kids say that?
No.
No, never. I don't care, he said, tramping over the snow in the twilight on his way from the Reinhardts. Christmas Eve. I wrote in my margin here, here's a reality that's not Sandy's. Candles and poinsettia flowers, wreaths of evergreen, baby trees hung with long strands of tinsel and fragile ornaments of colored glass. Sandy passed the windows of many white folks' houses, where the curtains were up and warm floods of electric light made bright and cozy rooms. In Negro shacks, too, there was the dim warmth of oil lamps and Christmas candles glowing. But at home, there wasn't even a holly wreath, and the snow was whiter and harder than ever on the ground. Tonight, though, look what they do. There were no clothes drying in the kitchen when he went in. The ironing board had been put away behind the door, and the whole place was made tidy and clean. The fire blazed and crackled in the little range, but nothing else said Christmas. No laughter, no tinsel, no tree. Angie had been about all day, still weak, but this afternoon she had made a trip to the store for a quarter's worth of mixed candies and nuts and a single orange, which she had hidden away until morning. Hagar had baked a little cake, but there was no frosting on it, such as there had been in other years, and there were no strange tissue-wrapped packages stuck away in the corners of trunks and drawers days ahead of time. Although the little kitchen was warm enough, the two bedrooms were chilly, and the front room was freezing cold because they kept the door there closed all the time. It was hard to afford a fire in one stove, let alone two, Aunt Hagar kept saying, with nobody working but herself. I was thinking about Harriet, she remarked after the Christmas Eve supper as she rocked before the fire, and how I's always tried to raise her right. Now we know, because this is chapter 12, we know in this novel where Harriet is and what she's doing. I was thinking about Harriet and how I always tried to raise her right. Let's turn the page. We can go to page 150. His mother leaves the house, and then that first whole paragraph on page 150. Where could she be going, he wondered, this time of night? He heard her footsteps crunching the hard snow, and, rolling over close to the window, he pulled aside the shade a little and looked out. In the moonlight, he saw Angie moving slowly down the street, past Sister Johnson's house, walking carefully over the snow like a very weak woman. And then he sees her leave, and he sees her come back at the top of page 151. Then a woman's cloaked figure came slowly back past Sister Johnson's house in the moonlight, and Sandy saw that it was his mother returning, her head down and her shadow moving blackly on the snow. You could hear the dry grate of her heels and the frozen whiteness as she walked, leaning forward, dragging something heavy behind her. Sandy prepared to lie down quickly in bed again, but he kept his eyes against the window pane to see what Angie was pulling. And as she came closer to the house, he could distinguish quite clearly behind her a solid homemade sled bumping rudely over the snow. What's happened? The obvious. I'm asking for the obvious.
Not gonna get the new sled.
Yep. He's not gonna get the new sled, and he knows it. And let's watch this little child now, disappointed in his dreams when reality has intruded itself, protect his mother. And it's a wonderful illustration, I think. It's only an image if you don't know. It's a wonderful illustration. Now, so skip two paragraphs, and then it's Christmas morning. Aren't you ever going to get up? Asked Angie, smiling timidly above him. It's Christmas morning, honey. Come see what Santa Claus brought you. Get up quick. He didn't want to get up. He knew what Santa Claus had brought him, and he wanted to stay in bed with his face to the wall. It wasn't a golden flyer sled, and now he couldn't even hope for one any longer. One of the things we see is that in the face of hope, how many times can hope be dashed by reality before one stops hoping? Well, until the reality is there, you still have, you know, if you were it's been dashed, and he can't even hope any longer. He wanted to pull the covers over his head and cry out, but, "Boy, you ain't up yet," called Aunt Hagar cheerily from the kitchen. "Your little Lord Jesus is in his manger filling all the world with light, and old Santa done been here and gone. Get out of there, child, and see." "I'm coming, Grandma," said Sandy slowly, wiping his tear-filled eyes and rolling out of bed as he forced his mouth. I love this. His tear-filled eyes and rolling out of bed as he forced his mouth to smile wide and steady at the few little presents he saw on the floor. For the child knew he was expected to smile. "Oh, a sled," he cried in a voice of mock surprise that wasn't his own at all. For there it stood, heavy and awkward against the wall, and beside it on the floor lay two picture books from the 10-cent store and a pair of white cotton gloves. Above the sled, his stocking tacked to the wall was partly filled with candy, and the single orange peeked out from the top. But the sled, homemade by some rough carpenter, with strips of rusty tin nailed along the wooden runners and a piece of clothesline to pull it with. It's fine, but it was very heavy and too wide for a boy to run with in his hands. You could never get a swift start, and a board was wrapped or warped in the middle. "It's a nice sled, Grandma," he lied. "I like it, Mama." "Mr. Logan made it for you," his mother announced proudly, happy that he was pleased. "I knew you wanted a sled all the time." "It's a nice sled," Sandy repeated. "It's an awful nice sled." Any response?
Yeah. It's exactly my story. My dad, it was during the Depression, 1929.
Yeah.
He couldn't buy me a sled, my brother and I, and he made us a sled, and we thought that sled was the most wonderful sled there was.
Great. It's a wonderful story, and the people across the tracks ain't so very different, are they?
No.
I mean, in this whole sense, that's a good story.
Well, can I just extend that a minute? I wonder if anything we've read so far really does say anything about growing up black in America. Aren't we really reading about class and economic situation more than black men?
Right. Mm-hmm. That's a really good question, and it's a complex kind of answer that I'll reduce to a sentence. Yes, it's economic, but the economic situation is perhaps created by racial prejudice and racism.
Well, not during the Depression.
During the
Depression, we were all poor. But it's just like me arguing with Tom Dixon, a friend I went to the University of Washington with, and we were both in the same program.
Yeah.
And Tom was telling me about his poverty when he was young, and I said, "Don't tell me anything about poverty, Tom. I was just as poor as you were."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Yes, but you weren't black." Mm-hmm. And I think that answers it right, myself.
Yeah, it is more, you're right, and that's a good point. It is more than an issue of poverty, because racial discrimination is still there in that discriminating society. You still can't escape their blackness. That's a whole other dimension, and that's part of this novel, as Sandy gets older, for sure.
Well, how old is Sandy now?
He's about 10.
Very mature.
Yeah, maybe he's 12 at the oldest.
Would as many white fathers be gone?
Well, there you are. Of course not. I mean, we have statistics on that. No way.
I think
which creates the economic situation.
The difficulty with getting a job was so much greater, and the families more often broken.
Maybe it's impossible.
My father was gone. There were six. We lived in South Dakota in the dust storms of the early 1930s.
Uh-huh.
I was about 13. I distinctly remember when I got an orange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the only orange I can remember for a period of several years until I grew up myself.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that that makes me the same situation as this black boy, but at that moment, we were on equal footing. But because I was white, I think I had a better chance to get out of it when the rains came seven years later than he did.
Yeah. But I think you're saying a lot of things, and one of the important things that at least I see as a student of this literature, as a white student of this literature, is that we can never ignore the racial oppression that's there, but we have a lot of commonalities too. And I think that adds a sense of sensitivity and appreciation to it. Rich?
I was just going to say, maybe we can relate to the economic poverty, but I think we maybe also need to accept the fact we can never relate to the blackness.
Yeah.
And if, even though we read it, we don't see it. And we don't have any concept of it.
How many of you were here the day we did the Martin Luther King essay? Quite a few. I won't do it again then, but I'll just throw out for those of you who weren't here, that day I asked people to list 5 to 10 nouns or adjectives describing yourself. And for instance, I gave the example, for instance, I would put down, I'm a teacher, I'm a coach, I'm a father, I'm a son, I like to think I'm a runner, but I'm really a jogger. and you list all those things. And then ask, and then I've done this in my classes back at Augustana College every year in the introductory course to black literature, and inevitably the white students don't put down white, and inevitably the black students put down black. And that's, I think, what Rich is suggesting, that there's something in our culture that reminds black people that they're black, and it's there, and it's there all the time. And there isn't something that reminds us that we're white. We're not conscious of our whiteness. And in another way, it's in, I think in some ways, a lot of males, we're not conscious of our maleness, whereas females are conscious of their being female, because our society has a kind of a oppressive power over those parts of it. Yeah.
It seems also that people have pointed out a lot of commonalities in the in comparing, you know, poverty stories. But in this country, one of the great things is somebody can go from nothing to great wealth. And so that I think that while a lot of people here in this room may have been as poor as anybody could be, they had the idols and the images to look up to. And I think that the blacks probably completely missed that 100%. Didn't know of, you know, the black family who had made it and didn't have that as an image.
Yep. To recognize those possibilities, it's good. Way in the back, I think, was first.
I wonder if a lot of people might identify with the descendancy. Like, I might be real likely to say I'm Norwegian. And also in terms of the discrimination thing, I remember my father-in-law talking about the fact that he only knew Swedish when he came to this country. And he was so ashamed of that he didn't... He forgot the whole language, but he had the other
English. Yeah.
Yeah,
thank you for sure.
Yeah. I don't know.
I was in your Martin Luther King class, and I said that I was white because I spent a long time in Africa, and I know what it's like to be outnumbered.
Good.
And another thing.
That's what it took to make you aware of that, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't. When I first saw white people after a long time of not seeing any, I thought they looked sick. But I felt the Africans, because they've seen us coming in, and we always have better cars, we live in better apartments over there, and we have more, they have things that they never had. The white, all associated with white men in America, everybody wanted to get away from their blackness and get away from Africa and come here. They don't like it. Now that they've seen something better, they are resentful about being there. And it's really unfortunate that we've done that in trying to help. And in trying to get what they have, their resources and whatever else is over there.
Thanks for sharing that. And we'll meet one of the daughters of Hagar has that same kind of experience, wants to kind of put back her, quote, blackness, because blackness in this society is not acceptable. I mean, you know what I mean by that? Acceptable in terms of making economic gains and social status and that sort of thing. So, for instance, at one point, Tempe, their daughter, not in the chapter we read, says, I would never eat a watermelon. And what she's doing is dismissing anything that might be traditionally attributed to black culture. And she's denying that, and that's part of of the greatness and the complexity of this whole novel that relates to what you said. I saw another here. Was it very good?
Well, I was saying I kind of can relate, because one time we went down to the interior of Mexico and we got lost. It was a frightening experience to be lost where we couldn't speak the language. We were white, and they looked at us with when we tried to ask a question, they looked at us with suspicion. What are we up? Why are we down there?
Yeah. But we should perhaps all experience something like that to be in the minority. Good. Let's finish this up, and then we'll sure have time to share even more of the dimensions of the whole story. Well, you've seen how Sandy reacts, and then I mentioned how he kind of protects Mom and Grandma from letting them know he's hurt and disappointed, and you, the wonderful line, "It's an awful nice sled." Then Tempe comes. Now Tempe, you'll see by her dialogue and what kind of experience she's having living in America. The second from the bottom, or the bottom paragraph there, page 153. Almost all Aunt Hager's callers knocked at the back door, but in the late afternoon, the front bell rang, and Angie sent Sandy through the cold parlor to answer. I mean, Tempe comes to the front door. There on the porch, knowing that it's been sealed off, you know, okay. There on the porch stood his Aunt Tempe with several gaily wrapped packages in her arms. She was almost a stranger to Sandy, yet she kissed him peremptorily on the forehead as he stood in the doorway. Then she came through the house into the kitchen with much the air of a mistress of the manor descending to the servants' quarters. "Land sakes alive," said Hagar, rising to kiss her. And I'm going to speed up some of the pace here just to point out something that Hagar has throughout the novel, and just so we sense it here in this chapter. Unconditional love. My daughter is a prostitute, and in the novel that has developed beautifully how their relationship is reconciled at Hagar's death. And it's reconciled because Hagar has this ability to love non-judgmentally. She doesn't care what her daughter's done. She welcomes her back with open arms. And now this other daughter who comes in and treats them almost like servants and condescends to the rest of their family, and listen to Hagar. Land sakes alive, rising to kiss her. She loves. She doesn't ask any questions at all. I have another literary allusion that I can just throw out that suggests you something about the Christian understanding that Langston Hughes brings to this novel, and he hasn't. In J.D. Salinger's book, Catcher in the Rye, the main character, Holden Caulfield, is talking with somebody else about Jesus and how Jesus picked his disciples. And Holden Caulfield's argument is, "But you know," he says to the little Quaker friend, "he picked them at random. And that has made all the difference." In other words, to put that in this understanding here, now, he didn't walk up and say, "Are you black or white? Are you rich or poor?" Or if you're teaching at an academic institution, and say, "What's your grade point? Are you straight or gay? Are you Republican or Democrat?" He picked them at random. And here we have, I think, Aunt Hagar demonstrating that randomness. She loves. She forgives. Land sakes, rising to kiss her. Tempe hugged Angie too before she sat down stiffly, as though the house had never been her home. Sorry. To little Willie May, she said nothing. That was a neighbor who came over too. "I'm sorry I couldn't invite you for Christmas dinner today, but you know how Mr. Siles," that's her husband, "you know how Mr. Siles is," Tempe began to explain to her mother and sister. "My husband is home so infrequently, and he doesn't like a house full of company, but of course, Dr. and Mrs. Glenn Mitchell will be in later in the evening. They drop around any time, but I had to run down and bring you a few presents." "You haven't seen my new piano yet, have you, Mother? I must come and take you home with me some nice afternoon." She smiled appropriately, but her voice was hard. "Hagar, how is you and your new church making it?" asked Hagar, slightly embarrassed in the presence of her finely dressed society daughter. "Wonderful, wonderful. Father Hill is so dignified, and the services are absolutely refined. There's never anything niggerish about them. So you know, Mother, they suit me." "I'm as glad you like it," says Hagar. "No, Jackie." There was an awkward silence, and then Tempe distributed her gifts. And then, we'll just read this because this is an important part and we'll be done. Then Tempe distributed her gifts, kissed them all as though it were her Christian duty, and went her way, saying that she had calls to make at Lawyer and Mrs. Moore's and Professor Booth's and Madam Temple's before she returned home. When she had gone, everybody felt relieved, as though a white person had left the house. Willie Mae began to play again, and Hagar pushed her feet out of her shoes once more while Angie went into the bedroom and lay down. And the end of this chapter tells, sets up the whole dynamics of tension that are here. Sandy sat on the floor and untied his present wrapped in several thicknesses of pink tissue paper and found in a bright Christmas box a big illustrated volume of Anderson's fairy tales decorated in letters of gold. What else did he get from his grandmother and mother?
Two books.
10-cent books. Good. Remember that. That was good. With its heavy pages and fine pictures, it made the 10-cent store books that Hager had brought him appear cheap and thin. It made his mother's sled look cheap, too, and shamed. Excuse me. All the other... I'm a bad reader. I get too choked up. And shamed all the other gifts the ones he loved had given him. "I don't want it," he said suddenly as loud as he could. "I don't want Tippy's old book." And from where he was sitting, he threw it with all his might underneath the stove. And watch Hagar gasp in astonishment. "Pick that up, sir. Your Aunt Tippy done bought you a fine pretty book, and here you throwing it underneath the stove in the ashes. Lord have mercy. Pick it up, I say, this minute." "I won't," cried Sandy stubbornly. "I won't. I like my sled and what you all gave me, but I don't want no old book from Tippy. I won't pick it up." Then the astonished Hagar grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and jerked him to his feet. "Do I have to whip you yet this holy day? Pick up that book, sir." "No," he yelled. She gave him a startled rap on the head with the back of her hand. "Talking sassy to you, old grandma, and telling her no?" "What is it?" Angie called from the bedroom as Sandy began to wail. "Nothing, except that this child's done all got inside herself as I has to hit him, that's all." Sandy was not hurt by his grandmother's easy rap. He was used to being struck on the back of the head for misdemeanors, and this time he welcomed the blow because it gave him at last what he had been looking for all day, a sufficient excuse to cry. Now his pent-up tears flowed without ceasing while Willie Mae sat in a corner clutching her rag doll to her breast, and Tempe's expensive gift lay in the ashes beneath the stone. For one thing, I hope, that's part of what I want to do, is have you have an appreciation for Langston Hughes. And not without laughter. Go get it. Okay? But some other things quickly, and then you share with us on this. I just divided some ideas that go on in the whole novel but are exemplified in this one chapter. The title out there on the bulletin board was Despair or Dreams, Growing Up Black. And on one side, depression and despair, and we've seen all kinds of reasons for depression in this novel, right? And then we see what happens to hope and to dreams. And under kind of category, kind of trying to compare these two with the concept of how do we define, or let's look at Langston Hughes, how does he define the self? The best sense of the word, self-definition. Out of your status in the general economy? Out of your personal wealth? I mean, what is their status in the general economy? This family we just read about. How do you feel about their sense of pride and love and self-esteem? Comfortable? Yeah. Strong? I mean, incredibly strong. So their definition of self does not come out of general economy. Anybody in that story that did? Tempe. Yeah. Personal wealth, was that a factor? Well, it's going to be kind of a tight Christmas this year, kids. But, I mean, Andy says Angie. What? Social respectability, church, friends, possessions. The self is defined apart from all of these things that are normally the defining things in our culture. I mean, we've talked in the past in some sessions about historical, cultural, religious, social, economic determining factors that in fact shape our own self-esteem and our own self-worth, as opposed to what creates the self-definition in this novel? Non-judgmental love? Acts for people? What are some of those acts that we saw here?
We're coming to the sled.
Going out to gather the wood for the sled. Good.
His lie.
Good.
Doing things for his aunt. And really meaning it at the end when he would rather have presents from them.
Yep. That's the image. Throwing that book under there. I don't want a present that comes from this side. What makes it a valuable present? Well, but it's not that. And Sandy rejects this. So again, I'll go back to the title. Not without laughter. And laughter comes because in this story because this side of their life so outweighs this side. I would suggest to you that I see that over and over again in American black literature. I see that in white literature too. I mean, the best literary artists understand that and recognize that the spirit is deeper than the defining powers. And cultural roots isn't as clear in this chapter. It is clear in the whole novel. In other words, simply the blackness, the toughness that comes from being spit on and being rejected and being sent to the back of the classroom because you're black and being called boy, and that's all part of the novel. And the strength rises above. Fire away. We've got a few minutes yet to share.
It struck me that Aunt Hagar is not an accidental name at all.
Yeah.
Because in the true sense of the word, those old hags were wonderful.
Yeah, that's good. And Tempe, yeah, that's very good.
In terms of perspective on their economic conditions, the fact that they owned a home at that time is, you know, I don't know in general what that Depression era economy was like, but I've heard in talks you heard earlier this week about the market in Brazil.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Is that really a step up from some people that they would probably have known at that in that society?
Yeah.
If they had
there are a lot of people renting, there are a lot of people, pardon me, go ahead.
Because they had a mortgage though. Because they go to the money lender who holds their mortgage.
Yeah.
So they all have a mortgage?
Yeah.
But I mean, I was under the impression there were a lot of people who weren't even rolled up.
They do
have that home with a mortgage.
It goes way back to the movements, the federal movements, federal programs involved in post-slavery days to get blacks on property. It didn't work very well because they gave them the worst land, and you know that's when the whole bit of I forgot the name of the word. Yeah. Thank you. That's a wonderful phrase, the three-dimensionalness of character as opposed to the one dimension of the TV picture. Good. Well, thank you. You're wonderful. And see you at the chapel or at the restaurant.